This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Protecting the President, an inside account of the troubled Secret Service in an era of evolving threats, by Dan Bongino, narrated by L.J. Ganser. Forward. If you ask any person living in America today what the United States Secret Service does, they will likely tell you, they're the guys who protect the president. And that is true. Quite simply, the brave men and women of the Secret Service have an awesome responsibility. They are tasked with keeping the single most important person on Earth, the President of the United States, alive and well. The agency does all this while being an indirect representation to the office of the President, the White House, and the people who are affiliated with the executive branch of our government, whether the service wants to be that representation or not. Agents of the Secret Service must maintain the highest tiers of security while simultaneously respecting privacy, maintaining discretion and trust, and understanding that the organization's own public image coincides with one of the most powerful political figures in the world. It's an incredible burden, and one to which we all owe our gratitude. When it is spelled out with such simplicity, it is equally simple to understand why mistakes and missteps in security just cannot happen. It is also easy to understand what the agency's fundamental mission is. Protection. The average American on the street seems to know it, so one would think that the agency understands it too. The highest order of the U.S. Secret Service is to keep the commander-in-chief safe. Anything else, to include image, is a moot point. When the agency was founded in 1865, it was commissioned to regulate and stop the spread of counterfeit currency in a post-Civil War era. Only later did it take on the mandate that it is so well known for today, that of executive protection at the highest level. This later mission has remained its fundamental core competency ever since, and it is what sets the United States Secret Service apart from other federal law enforcement agencies. Although investigations have remained an intricate part of the career of a U.S. Secret Service special agent, the understanding is protection is why everyone is there. But in the last few decades, the United States Secret Service has forgotten where it began and what it is. An agency that once defined itself by protecting people without negotiating how it will do it, now does so with a wink and a nod understanding that the criteria of protection is open to interpretation and adjustment. Someone in the agency came in one day and started replacing right and wrong with black and white, and incorrectly thought that the two meant the same thing. The right thing is often the hard thing to do. If the right thing were easy, everyone would do the right thing all the time. And we know that doesn't happen. The organization that once told presidents where they could and could not go decided one day to let White House staffers tell them how to secure a site for a visit, and it has never been the same. Leaders who once did the right thing for their agents have been replaced with managers who buckle under the pressure of scheduling ridiculous hours of work for their subordinates, and the lack of morale and high attrition rate speaks for itself as the result. Field office agents who were once locked arm in arm with their local law enforcement brethren on a protection assignment now tell their local counterparts to stand in corners, out of sight of the protectees who do not wish to see them. The leaders of yesteryear would have never tolerated such treatment of their law enforcement brothers. But the new and improved Secret Service allows this to occur daily, and is blessed at the highest levels of its management offices to do so. The mission used to be protection, but the new core competency in today's U.S. Secret Service is image. The agency has sacrificed its mission for its beauty. For myself, joining the cadre of the United States Secret Service started 20 years before my first day on the job. As a young child, I had the privilege of having a friend whose father was an agent. My friend's father was a powerful, positive influence for me in my young life, and it was that influence that propelled my ambition to become a Secret Service agent. All the professional choices in my life, to include military college, my service to my country as military officer, and just staying out of trouble in my youth, were all a means to an end for me. That end was to become a U.S. Secret Service agent. The day that I received the call telling me that I was accepted into the agency was one of the happiest, proudest days of my life. I was home alone when the personnel office called, and I paced excitedly while I waited for my wife to come home from work to give her the news. When she arrived home and I told her, she leapt into my arms with an excited squeal. It was wonderful. Exciting time for us both, filled with a promise for the future and assurance that I was about to be a part of something special and meaningful for my country. To be part of a great, honorable agency with a single mission focus. I could not have been more disappointed when I arrived. The very first thing I noticed was the lack of leadership and accountability amongst the agency. Supervisors were motivated by minute details on meaningless paperwork, and were quick to criticize young agents for ridiculous, subjective things. Abuses in authority were commonplace amongst managers, and morale was terribly low. Truly, the only thing I remember fondly about those days was the camaraderie and bonds I developed with my fellow boot agents. I genuinely missed the times with those people, and there were only a very limited few supervisors who earned my respect in those days. After 9 years, I could take no more. I became another casualty to the problems, the cancer that infects the agency today. From lack of quality management to morale to the hemorrhaging of personnel, the United States Secret Service is in dire need of major overhaul. With this being one of the most polarizing political atmospheres in our country's history, the demand for quality protection for our leaders is needed now more than ever, so the timing for the U.S. Secret Service to buckle under its own weight could not be worse. When Dan told me that he was considering writing this book, I enthusiastically encouraged him to do so. Anyone who knows Dan Bongino tends to use words like character, integrity, and morality when describing him. In our time together as agents in the Baltimore field office, it was obvious Dan was a right and wrong kind of guy, and not a black and white one. No one, professionally or personally, is better qualified to outline the problems that plague the United States Secret Service today. No one is better qualified to address the issues and offer the right answers to fix those problems. As I read through Dan's book, I remembered the reasons why I joined the agency all those years ago, and also why I left. Although it is too late for me, the issues can still be corrected to make it an agency that future young men and women will dedicate their lives to joining, and will proudly stay with for their careers. It's not too late for the U.S. Secret Service to return to its former glory. The roadmap to do that is in the pages before you, spelled out by the person who knows best how the agency can once again do the right things. Jason Wells, U.S. Secret Service, 2005 to 2013, author of Our Path to Safety, a U.S. Secret Service Agent's Guide to Creating Safe Communities. Introduction. I've had a lot of jobs. I've stocked grocery shelves, delivered newspapers, patrolled crime-ridden streets as an NYPD police officer, consulted on business deals, hosted talk radio shows, hosted a successful podcast, and authored a couple of successful books. I've been a student many times, and a teacher a few times, but the position I'll always be proudest of is that of Special Agent, United States Secret Service. Being a United States Secret Service agent is an awesome responsibility. A seasoned Secret Service agent knows how to be a cop, a diplomat, a peacemaker, a counselor, and a bodyguard. Although I and the agents I still call friends hate that term when describing what the Secret Service does. The Secret Service is a relatively flat organization, managerially, and as a result, they operate in a sink-or-swim environment where rank-and-file agents are given a significant amount of responsibility early on in their careers. It's not uncommon for a new special agent, only months or even days out of the Secret Service Training Academy, to be charged with designing an impenetrable security plan for a foreign head of state visiting the United States. During the annual United Nations General Assembly in New York City, tens to hundreds of foreign heads of state visit the United Nations in New York City, and they are all the responsibility of the United States Secret Service. But the Secret Service is, at best, a medium-sized federal agency that doesn't have the luxury of hundreds of thousands of experienced agents to cover every nook and cranny of New York City during the UN General Assembly. As a result, newer agents are forced, every year, to step up to the plate early in their careers and hit a security home run. There are no bunts allowed. Those agents who can handle the pressure of keeping the world's most powerful leaders secure will be the future leaders of the Presidential Protective Division, a Secret Service agent's most coveted assignment, and of the Secret Service at large. Those who fail will be stuck investigating counterfeit currency cases out of a Secret Service field office to which no one wanted to be assigned, involving teenagers using mommy's color printer to create terrible-looking faux $100 bills for the rest of their careers. Being a Secret Service agent is a pressure cooker. But for those men and women who live for the rush of adrenaline that comes with fast motorcades, world travel, big responsibilities, and even bigger threats, it's the greatest job in the world. When I first joined the Secret Service in 1999, the agency was overflowing with applications. And when I made it through the arduous special agent selection process, I was genuinely surprised. Although I had faith in my abilities, I was convinced that my application was going to be swallowed up by the thousands of applications from incredibly qualified men and women the Secret Service was receiving for every special agent opening. I was honored to be a special agent, and the United States Secret Service special agent title instantly became part of me. The Secret Service was a proud, successful model government agency in 1999, and it reflected in the relatively high esprit de corps, all the way from the upper management of the agency through the administrative staff. In the early part of my nearly 12-year career with the Secret Service, I was sent over to Moscow on a temporary investigative assignment. While there, I made friends with the FBI agent, who also had an office at the American Embassy in Moscow. During one of our many conversations, he was surprised to learn that the Secret Service allowed non-supervisory agents to conduct security advances for the president, vice president, and foreign heads of state. He was also surprised to learn that I was assigned as an instructor at the Secret Service Training Academy and that I was not a supervisor. He seemed particularly perplexed that I was assigned to the Russian embassy on a prestigious investigative assignment as nothing more than a GS-13 federal agent. Secret Service supervisors are all GS-14 and above. He told me that in the FBI, most of the critical investigations, assignments, and FBI Academy instructor positions were filled either by senior special agents or supervisors. The Secret Service doesn't work that way. Every special agent, whether a supervisor or not, is expected to be able to handle, on a moment's notice, an assignment where failure could mean the death of a world leader and a corresponding Archduke Ferdinand-like global crisis. But the Secret Service is now living through an existential crisis. The overseas scandals, the fence jumpers, the Salahi incident, the stolen laptop, and other organizational black eyes on the agency have created a media and political feeding frenzy. Fair or unfair, media outlets smelled the blood in the water and saw the dollar signs from the clickbait headlines about the smallest Secret Service transgression, and they reported on every story, no matter how thinly sourced. Some of these stories about the Secret Service were so misleading that the media outlets were forced to alter their headlines because the original reporting was not accurate. Remember the story about the Secret Service agents who crashed a car into a White House barricade? Did you happen to notice the follow-up stories days after the original reporting, which described the exact same incident as Secret Service agents nudging a temporary orange traffic barrier? Which one was it? Did the agents crash into a barrier, or did they nudge a traffic cone? One of these happened, and one clearly did not. The answer was obvious to anyone who viewed the security video of the incident, which was made public just days after it occurred. But it didn't matter. The media smelled blood, and they knew that using the word crashed to describe the incident, no matter how ridiculous and sensationalist, would generate eyeballs to their networks and clicks to their websites. It mattered little to these media figures that they destroyed the careers of the two agents involved in the incident, despite both of them having earned reputations as stellar performers and career-long team players. Lawmakers, themselves not immune to the smell of publicity blood in the water, jumped into the fray as well, and they have begun to question everything about the Secret Service, including its need to exist as a separate government agency. After the many crises the Secret Service has faced, a reasonable person would conclude that these incidents would serve as a wake-up call to the upper management of this once great agency. But according to my many sources within the Secret Service, it's been largely business as usual, despite the withering media, legislative, and public pressure being put on the agency to evolve and improve. That's why I decided to write this book. Although I feel strongly that the Secret Service has faced an unusual amount of unfair media coverage, the agency's problems are very real, and they require immediate action. The President of the United States is in genuine danger if the Secret Service doesn't change course soon and evolve with the rapidly changing threat environment. The threats to the White House and the President are swiftly evolving in this new era of weaponized drones, micro-sized video surveillance technology, vehicle attacks on civilians, small arms tactical assaults, and technologically advanced and difficult-to-detect explosives. And if the decision-makers in the Secret Service refuse to evolve with this series of threats, then, tragically, we may suffer the first loss of a president since John F. Kennedy. When I was a young Secret Service agent going through their special agent training program, the primary threats we trained to stop were single-shooter-type attacks, such as the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan. The response to an attack such as the Reagan shooting, and the corresponding training that accompanies it, are far different from the response to a weaponized drone flying directly into a presidential motorcade. The simplest example of this is weapons technology. The weapons most effective in suppressing a rapid-fire, single-person, handgun-based attack, such as the Reagan shooting, are not the same weapons that would be effective against an organized terrorist team's assault on the White House grounds, using mortars, explosives, and automatic rifles. I know many of you listening to this book may be wondering, why give the bad guys any ideas by writing about security problems? That's both a fair and an appropriate question, but I assure you, the bad guys already have these ideas, and worse, would carry them out tomorrow if the logistics involved with planning an attack on the White House were easier. But logistics can be figured out as long as the motivation to attack remains intact. And terrorism shows no signs of abating. Terrorist planners will find a way to acquire the technology, the weapons, the explosives, and the know-how to eventually make an attempt on the life of the President of the United States. The real question we should all be asking is, what the hell are we going to do about it? Part 1. What's wrong with the Secret Service? Chapter 1. The Special Agent Mess. When large organizations experience systemic failures, these failures can be either top-down failures, driven by poor management decisions, or a bottom-up phenomenon, where the management's strategic plan was a good one, but the execution by the employees fails. Unfortunately, the special agent side of the Secret Service has seen its share of both types of failures. But the critical problems facing the Secret Service special agent side today are primarily due to sclerotic management, obsessed with the old way of doing things. Secret Service headquarters-based upper management is dangerously risk-averse and non-responsive to the evolving threat environment Secret Service special agents face. Combine this with the endless zeal by Secret Service management to expand the mission of the Secret Service despite insufficient manpower and training to do so, and we have an agency on the verge of collapse. When I joined the Secret Service in 1999, the dreaded Y2K crisis was on everyone's mind, and the agency had just completed a successful security operation for the visit of Pope John Paul II to the United States. Morale was universally high, and job complaints were few. Being a Secret Service agent in 1999 carried with it an unmistakable swagger. The agency had long since recovered from the multiple assassination attempts on Gerald Ford by Lynette Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore, and the shooting of Ronald Reagan by John Hinckley Jr., and the Secret Service was riding a successful, nearly two-decade-long streak of relatively scandal-free operations. The morning I reported for my first day on the job as an agent, I was seated in the small but professional-looking and well-maintained, which surprised me, given that I left the New York City Police Department to join the Secret Service, and the facilities were in atrocious condition, lobby of the Secret Service's New York field office, located in the pre-September 11th, 2001, Seven World Trade Center building. I recall being impressed by the bravado and confidence of the agents who kept walking by. The New York field office had a swipe card and PIN-based entry system at the time, and to get from one side of the office to the other, or one floor to the other, many of the agents would use the lobby as a shortcut. Every agent who entered the lobby would stop at the access control box, which would make a distinct beeping sound as each number of the agent's access PIN was entered. The scramble pad would scramble the digits on the keypad each time, so agents would have to bend over to look at the pad to see which keys to press. This prevented any onlookers from detecting an agent's PIN when it was entered on the keypad. As I sat in the lobby, both excited and anxious about my first day as a Secret Service agent, I noticed that every agent who passed me did the same thing. None of them looked at me directly, but instead they would bend over the scramble pad and, thinking I wasn't looking at them, tilt their heads to catch a glimpse at the new guy and then go on their way. Their collective glances at me all screamed the same thing. This is the Secret Service. Are you ready? When I and the other rookie agents I was hired with were finally allowed into the office with a special agent escort, I noticed the same confidence and swagger among the agents wandering the hallways. Everyone was talking about a big counterfeit arrest they had just made, a door they'd just knocked down on an arrest warrant, or how one of the New York field office agents had just gotten picked up by the detail, Secret Service jargon for being reassigned to the Presidential Protective Division. Adding icing to the swagger cake, which all of the agents I ran into on my first day seemed to be eating, was our interaction with an agent headed out on a criminal search warrant. The agent, a solid 200-plus pounds of muscle wearing a New York Large T-shirt, note, this is a standard medium-sized shirt for the non-bodybuilder crowd across the fruited plains outside of New York City, paraded by with a battering ram breaching tool designed to forcibly take down a locked door while executing a search warrant. As he passed, he told us, in the loudest inside voice possible, note, this would be called screaming by a non-New Yorker, about the perp, short for perpetrator, they were going to lock up that day. If you were casting a movie about street-hardened New York Secret Service agents, you couldn't have had a more successful casting location than the hallways of the New York field office on my first day. The whole scene was overwhelming and impressive. And although everyone I ran into that day had an unmistakable swagger and confidence, it wasn't misplaced or rude. For me, a young 20-something who had only known about the Secret Service through Hollywood movies and fiction books, but had always idolized the Secret Service and their awesome mission, this air of self-assurance was simply the fulfilling of my high expectations. It would be no different from walking into the New York Yankees locker room after a World Series winning season and noticing that same swagger. You would probably be disappointed if you entered the Yankees locker room under these circumstances and saw the team with hanging heads, their shoulders hunched, bitching and moaning about how terrible it was to be a Yankee. Thankfully, That was not the case in the New York field office, and it was clear to me that these seasoned agents were proud of their chosen profession and knew how to win. Athletes and coaches talk about learning how to win all the time, and it's an indispensable part of a successful organization. Aaron Rodgers, the Super Bowl-winning MVP quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, once told the sports media before a playoff game, "I think you have to learn how to win in the playoffs." Notice Rodgers didn't say, "I think you have to learn how to play in the playoffs." He specifically said, "Learn how to win." Learning to win is a longitudinal exercise in repeated, successful execution that imbues an organization with an attitudinal productivity factor, not explainable by the sum of individual efforts. Being on a winning team is the X factor teams and coaches have been trying to bottle and recreate throughout the history of human competition in both sports and business. But sometimes having the best players or the brightest employees doesn't translate into learning how to win. Just ask the 2004 USA basketball team, which finished with a disappointing bronze Olympic medal despite having a team composed of elite NBA All-Stars. In 1999, the Secret Service was an organization that knew exactly how to win. At some point between the closing years of the Bill Clinton presidency and the Secret Service transfer from the Department of the Treasury to the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, in 2003, the Secret Service stopped winning. As special agents during this 2003 transfer, many of us were unsure about how it was going to impact the mission, or us personally, in the future. But the actual transfer was relatively uneventful. We all received shiny new badges and identification cards. But other than those cards reading Department of Homeland Security rather than the Department of the Treasury, and the badges getting bigger and shinier, the new DHS badges added a large silver five-pointed star overlay on top of a new gold badge, nothing really changed in the short term. Our paychecks were still direct deposited in our bank accounts in the same amounts, and the paperwork to conduct criminal investigations, security advances, to inventory evidence, and to account for our man hours, despite desperately needing revision, all remained unchanged. Even our offices stayed in the same locations as they were before the transfer. I, along with many agent colleagues of mine, pondering the non-event of the transfer, began to wonder after a few months what the point of the transfer to DHS was. If consolidation and efficiency improvements through the leveraging of economies of scale and scope weren't the goals of the transfer, and nothing really changed on the ground, then why did the politicians and bureaucratic class make this move? Looking back on the decisions through the lens of the post-September 11, 2001 world, it appears that the decision was a reactionary political solution, looking for a problem to solve. The Secret Service was winning and performing admirably under the Treasury Department and, ironically, doing so using half of the roughly $2 billion federal tax dollars it currently consumes. If you asked a handful of senior Secret Service agents why the Secret Service stopped winning during the period in question, you would get an assortment of different answers. But many of those answers would include the infamous DHS transfer, poor management, a broken pay scale, a broken promotion system, and the expanding mission of the Secret Service that immediately preceded the DHS transfer. Many of the agents in my cohort called the DHS transfer the hostile takeover, and saw almost nothing positive come from it, while simultaneously noting that the winning stopped after the transfer. In my experience, most of the special agent mess that occurred immediately before and pursuant to the DHS transfer can be attributed to the significant mission creep that occurred within the Secret Service during those years. When the Secret Service was located within the Treasury Department, they had limited criminal investigative duties, and they're tacitly understood, because Secret Service management couldn't acknowledge formally that their criminal investigations were often sidelined in lieu of protection missions, or they would run the risk of losing the investigative functions altogether. Primary function was protection. To the rank-and-file special agents, this was always understood to mean that whatever criminal case you were working on at the time, whether it was a counterfeit currency case or a credit card fraud case, the investigation was going to take a back seat if a Secret Service protectee came into your district. We all knew that we were expected to drop everything when the president, vice president, their families, or a foreign head of state planned to visit our assigned areas of responsibility. This drop everything for protection agency mindset caused a lot of headaches with the local assistant United States attorneys, the government prosecutors assigned to prosecute federal investigations through the federal legal system. Because if an agent was assigned to a case where a federal arrest had been made and the prosecution phase had begun, the assistant U.S. attorneys would have to constantly juggle around the court schedule based on the ability of the Secret Service agents to appear. Federal judges weren't big fans of this either, and wouldn't hesitate to let us know through the assistant U.S. attorneys. This drop-everything-for-protection approach to federal investigations hit close to home with me during the prosecution phase of a multi-million-dollar credit card fraud ring I was investigating in 2000 and 2001. The suspects in the case had unlocked a proprietary algorithm that credit card companies used to create account numbers, and they were probing the numbers with small, nearly unnoticeable purchases to determine which credit card numbers were active. When they found an active card number, they would create a counterfeit credit card bearing the stolen account number, and then proceed to local chain stores to buy gift cards. They would sell the gift cards for cash at a discount later. The scam was enormous in size and scope. Hundreds of millions of dollars were lost to fraud in this scam, and it was suspected that a portion of the ill-gotten gains was being used to finance international terror groups. We broke up the scheme after months of painstaking surveillance and investigative forensics, when we caught a low-level operator in the scheme on camera using one of the counterfeit credit cards in a hardware store. With a criminal case of this magnitude, a casual observer would think that the Secret Service would prioritize the investigation. But, unfortunately, that wasn't the case. The Secret Service is a protection-centric agency, and Hillary Clinton was running for the U.S. Senate seat in New York at the time. Due to the competitive nature of the race, Mrs. Clinton became a frequent visitor to Long Island, the area of New York I was assigned to cover. Each visit by Mrs. Clinton delayed the investigation and prosecution of the credit card fraud case, as I was pulled off the case to do security advances and protection assignments. The size of the fraud case, based on the incredible volume of credit card numbers stolen, combined with the mounting financial losses in the hundreds of millions, made the workload for the case suffocating, given my expanding protective responsibilities with Mrs. Clinton. Thankfully, I worked the case with an understanding FBI agent who would fill in for me when I had to cancel a court appearance or an appointment with the assistant U.S. attorney. I learned to forget about weekends because the week never actually ended. I would go from a criminal surveillance related to the fraud case to protection, to court, and then repeat the cycle the next week. I spent weekends either on protection or formulating reports on the fraud case. Still, although it was a headache balancing the dual protection and investigative missions of the Secret Service, it was manageable outside of campaign season. The Hillary Clinton protection workload was an exception because the Long Island Secret Service office to which I was assigned only had a few working agents assigned to it, unlike the New York field office, which had hundreds of special agents assigned there. The assistant U.S. attorneys gave us a lot of slack. It didn't hurt that we would get them pictures with the Secret Service protectees if they asked. It was right around this busy time in my nascent Secret Service career that the Secret Service's dual mission started transforming into the never-ending mission. The agents were still adjusting to the dramatic increase in protection assignments because of the unprecedented situation that had developed with Hillary Clinton. Secret Service agents had historically had a light travel schedule when they were assigned to the First Lady's detail, FLD. But Mrs. Clinton's decision to run for the U.S. Senate in New York changed all of that. Her schedule mutated into a campaign schedule, not a first lady's schedule, which largely consisted of ceremonial events in the past. And although morale was still strong, despite the onslaught of protective assignments emanating from the Presidential Protective Division's Operations Section, responsible for handling the logistics for the First Lady's travel, I began to hear grumblings from agents about the relentless protection workload. Unfortunately, the growing portfolio of protection assignments due to Mrs. Clinton's campaign for office happened not long after the Secret Service took on the lead role for securing nationally significant events determined to be National Special Security Events, NSSE, in 2000, pursuant to the Presidential Decision Directive 62, PDD 62, and the Presidential Threat Protection Act of 2000. Initially, the Secret Service's new role in securing NSSE events was limited by the infrequency of the designation. Before the DHS transfer, it was relatively uncommon for an event to be designated an NSSE, and as a result, the detailed planning and manpower requirements needed from the Secret Service to secure these NSSE events were limited. But after the DHS transfer, these events became more regular, as seemingly every national summit or sports event tried to pass off their security costs to the federal government by obtaining an NSSE designation and having the Secret Service pick up the security tab. These NSSE events, from the Salt Lake City, Utah Winter Olympics to the Sea Island, Georgia G8 Summit, were all vacuums, sucking up Secret Service manpower and forcing agents into unmanageable professional lives and even more stressful personal lives. As a result of the growing demand for its security services through the NSSE designation, the Secret Service expanded and started a new division to handle NSSE events. The new division was called the Major Events Division, MED, and as with every new government creation, this division has to be staffed with Secret Service agent personnel, with a fresh influx of taxpayer dollars to the agency to pay for it. The MED and the NSSE designation began a few years before the transfer to DHS, but in the eyes of many of the agents working through the DHS transfer, the correlation between the mission creep of the Secret Service and their deteriorating home lives and unmanageable work schedules left an indelible mark, and the DHS transfer became a convenient source of blame and agency scorn. Pursuant to the Secret Service's new NSSE responsibilities as national event planners, special agents were now being asked to act as elite protection agencies for the world's most threatened men and women, to function as Tier 1 financial crimes criminal investigators and, as a result of the NSSE designation, to function as security guards for events with a lobbying staff big enough or connected to enough of the right people to obtain an NSSE designation. This is a story about the fall of the Secret Service that is rarely told in the media, but I lived it, and the complaints started to pile up as the NSSE events did. One of the complaints I heard often in the early 2000s, as the Secret Service was expanding at an uncontrollable rate, was, "I didn't sign up to be a security guard for a bunch of connected insiders." Keep in mind, many of these men and women signed up to be Secret Service special agents, aspiring to protect the President of the United States. But the NSSE designation meant that many of these agents were securing events that the President didn't even necessarily attend. Skipping a few court dates on a big criminal investigation to protect the First Lady, the President, or a foreign head of state was what most of the agents understood as their calling, not watching a door for 12 hours outside of some international summit of self-important international wannabe big shots. The hit to Special Agent morale was devastating. Unfortunately, the Secret Service mission creep didn't end with the expansion into NSSE events and the founding of the Major Events Division. In the late 90s and early 2000s, the New York field office started informally investigating cellular phone fraud occurring within New York City. No one in Congress, the Treasury Department, or the Department of Homeland Security told the Secret Service to do these investigations. The New York field office was simply responding to a barrage of complaints about cloned cellular phones and the subsequent requests from the cell phone industry to do something about it. The cloning of cell phones was an enormous problem for both the cellular phone industry and their customers during the late 1990s and early 2000s, and it was doing real damage to consumer confidence in the burgeoning industry. Every cell phone has an electronic serial number, ESN. In addition to the phone number, and technologically savvy thieves were using radio frequency interception devices to steal the phone number and the ESN combinations from cell phone owners and cloning them onto other cell phone devices. This enabled the thieves to sell cloned cellular phones, which would then be billed to the legitimate owner of the phone with the authentic ESN phone number combination. Seeking help with this problem, representatives from some of the major cell phone service providers, who had worked previously with members of the Secret Service's New York field office on financial crimes cases, began to work with their special agent contacts on investigating and prosecuting the cell phone fraudsters. Seems harmless enough, right? Well, it wasn't. As agents from the New York field office investigated increasing numbers of these cases, the Secret Service's investigative mission began to expand correspondingly. The investigative mission at that time was clear. The Secret Service was charged with investigating counterfeit U.S. currency and financial crimes, such as check kiting, bank fraud, credit card fraud, and U.S. Treasury check fraud. The Secret Service was not set up in the late 1990s to be an agency responsible for the investigation of electronic crimes, such as cellular phone cloning. Yet this is exactly what happened. The Secret Service and its headquarters management got starry-eyed seeing the potential gusher of post-retirement jobs in lucrative technology fields, such as the cellular phone industry. Add to that the pressure from a group of mid-level Secret Service managers in the New York field office and voila! The Secret Service became an electronic crimes investigative outfit, as well as a protection agency, national event planners, and a financial crimes outfit. It happened. I was there. At this point, you may be asking, was there an act of Congress based on some study of Secret Service capabilities to take on this mammoth investigative responsibility in the electronic crimes sphere that led to the Secret Service becoming the federal law enforcement agency responsible for leading the federal electronic crimes task forces? Unfortunately, no, there wasn't. The Secret Service's humble electronic crimes beginnings, investigating cell phone cloning, rapidly evolved into one of the largest cases of federal law enforcement mission creep in modern history, as the investigation of cell phone fraudsters morphed into the New York field office's Electronic Crimes Task Force, ECTF. Led by a charismatic first-level supervisor at the time, whom I'll call Bill, the New York field office, ECTF, began to expand its tentacles into computer crimes, internet child pornography, unauthorized movie and music trading over the internet, and, critically, the trading of stolen credit card information over the internet. Bill was a smooth operator with a Rolodex of contacts that would make the phone book jealous, and he rapidly expanded the mission of the New York field office ECTF and, by proxy, the Secret Service. He almost single-handedly expanded the mission of the Secret Service by contacting technology leaders and offering to work with them in the investigation and prosecution of criminals exploiting the still relatively new internet for criminal purposes. Bill was a hard-working and dedicated agent, and I am in no way attempting to impugn his character by writing about his efforts to stem the growing menace of internet-based crimes. But as with many good intentions within government, the real-world results of this new and expanded Secret Service mission was an expansion of the Secret Service mission not commensurate with its experience, manpower, or equipment capabilities. This further damaged Special Agent morale as the agency workload continued to expand unabated. The impact of this dramatic expansion of the Secret Service's traditional statutory investigative role and into the electronic crimes arena impacted me personally and many of the other members of the Special Agent workforce in 2003 and 2004. The origins of the dramatic drop in Secret Service morale within the New York field office, based on my many conversations with agents working in the office at the time, can be traced to this time period due to the New York office ECTF's investigation of Shadow Crew, a fraud case later made famous when it was featured on CNBC's popular television show, American Greed. This large and nearly unmanageable Secret Service electronic crimes case, dubbed Operation Firewall by the agency, was in the eyes of many of the Secret Service's headquarters managers their way to show the world what the Secret Service could do in the electronic crimes arena. Operation Firewall was a complicated international investigation where an organized group of technologically sophisticated thieves traded in large numbers of stolen credit card numbers over websites they monitored and managed. One of the Secret Service's key informants in the case, a man named Albert Gonzalez, was to provide a window into the operations of the websites trafficking in these stolen credit card numbers. Gonzalez later made a fool of the agency when it was discovered that during the course of his informant work for the New York ECTF, he was also committing additional internet-based crimes by hacking into corporate networks to steal more credit card information. Operation Firewall could have appropriately been called Operation Chaos within the Secret Service's New York field office, because chaos is exactly what this case caused. The Secret Service's dual investigative mission was becoming unmanageable as the 1990s ended and the new millennium began. The use of Secret Service agent manpower to plan for and secure NSSE events, the corresponding staffing of the new Secret Service Major Events Division, the expanding portfolio of people under Secret Service protection after the 9/11 terror attacks, and the new electronic crimes investigative mission strained the agency to the point of bursting. When the George W. Bush re-election effort and the corresponding presidential election campaign season began in 2003, agency morale soured across the country. I was assigned to a satellite office of the New York field office at the time, based on Long Island, and I recall a steady stream of complaints from agents forced to spend months on the road supporting presidential travel for the campaign, while many of the Operation Firewall agents were hands-off. Hands-off was Secret Service manpower jargon for agents taken off of the protection travel rotation, known as the ROTA, short for rotation. To ensure that agent travel from the Secret Service field offices around the country and the world in support of the protection mission of the agency was equitably distributed among its international workforce, the Secret Service developed the ROTA to prevent agents from burning out on the road. Traveling for protection assignments in the Secret Service wasn't much of a hardship when I was a young agent, full of vigor and eager to see the world. But after years spent on the road, and after marriage and children, I, along with most of my agent co-workers who had families, found travel to be incredibly tedious, and we all looked forward to our own beds, time with our families, and home-cooked meals. Operation Firewall screwed up the ROTA for agents all across the country, because the size of the investigation had vacuumed up dozens of agents across multiple field offices who were all pulled off the ROTA to support the Operation Firewall investigation. The complexity of the Operation Firewall case only stoked the flames of division within the Secret Service, because many of the agents, forced to spend additional weeks on the road in protection assignments because of the shrunken ROTA, didn't even understand what the hell the case was about and why the Secret Service was even involved in electronic crime. Put yourself in the shoes of a married agent with children during this period, trying to explain to a wife working her own 8-hour day while also driving the kids to school, preparing their lunches, bathing them, and soothing crying young ones, that you're on the road for an additional 3 weeks because of an electronic crime case being run out of the New York Field Office, ECTF. Understandably, many of the spouses were pissed off, and they let their special agent husbands and wives know about it. Many of the spouses had been with their agent husbands and wives through the early 1990s, and they remembered protective travel assignments. But few could recall their husbands or wives being endlessly on the road. Compounding matters and aggravating the souring morale among agents outside of the hands-off Operation Firewall was the arrogant attitude some of the agents involved in the investigation of the case displayed toward the many of us in the New York field office and its satellite offices who were managing our own complex criminal investigations while also traveling around the globe to support protection missions. Why am I canceling court dates and putting my investigations on hold to support the Operation Firewall agents? We asked. One of the ironic and lasting consequences of the Operation Firewall investigation wasn't just its role in damaging morale and causing a spike in attrition, as many New York agents simply left the job when work conditions deteriorated. The mishandling of the case was also damaging to the Secret Service's investigative reputation. This is troubling, because the gravity of the case, as measured by the catastrophic losses to the credit card industry and the unprecedented use of the dark web, presented a real opportunity for the Secret Service to shine when it broke up this major international fraud ring. But it wound up having the opposite effect. The Secret Service entered the electronic crime sector through its early work on cell phone fraud cases, and the industry contacts Bill had developed working these cases. It expanded, largely without the training and expertise to do so, into the Internet crimes sector, and immediately plunged itself into the enormous Operation Firewall investigation. New York field office ECTF agents then broke the case by turning a member of the criminal organization running the fraud scheme into a paid federal law enforcement informant. This informant, hired as a government cooperator, then turned on the Secret Service and used his vastly superior computer knowledge, given the Secret Service's lack of training and expertise in electronic crimes at the time, to commit additional crimes while, astonishingly, on the government payroll. The agents investigating this case were then pulled off of the travel rota, forcing the government to pay extra taxpayer dollars in overtime to overworked Secret Service agents, forced to stay on the road and remain on the rota, to cover for the agents monitoring the informant who is screwing over the Secret Service. This series of unfortunate events further damaged Secret Service agent morale and subsequently led to a spike in resignations. The disastrous handling of the case was a source of more fuel for the brewing discontent and worsening morale within the once proud agency. In addition, many of the Operation Firewall agents, with their favorable work schedules due to their roles in the investigation, had availed themselves of some of the best contacts the technology industry offered as a result of being assigned to the ECTF. They then used these contacts to leave the Secret Service and take lucrative positions within many of the companies that were part of the Operation Firewall investigation, or working with the ECTF. It's an almost unbelievable story until you realize that it's the federal government at the heart of it. Only the government can manage screw-ups like this with virtually no long-term accountability. The federal law enforcement bureaucracy has countless stories like this, which provides additional evidence pointing to an aimless law enforcement alphabet soup of federal agencies with no credible long-term plan that delegates both de facto and statutory investigative authority to federal law enforcement agencies based on connections, parochial desires, and accidents of history. Ironically, even the Secret Service's role as a protection agency came about not as a result of a detailed plan based on the Secret Service's capabilities and expertise, but because of public pressure to protect our presidents after the assassination of President William McKinley in September 1901. The Secret Service was informally protecting McKinley's successor, Vice President Theodore Roosevelt, after McKinley's assassination, but they only became formally responsible for this mission years later, in 1906. The Secret Service was founded in 1865, not to protect the president, but to investigate the growing stock of counterfeit currency in the United States. Protecting the president is not a mission that requires the same set of skills necessary to conduct complex financial crimes investigations. Yet, similar to its usurpation of investigative responsibilities in the electronic crimes arena, it took over as the nation's premier personal protection agency based on proximity to power and an accident of history. The Secret Service's lead federal law enforcement role in the investigation of electronic crimes is now formal, despite its inability to manage its pre-electronic crimes investigative and protection missions. The 2001 Patriot Act, signed into law by President George W. Bush, cemented into law the Secret Service's role as the lead agency responsible for the coordination of the nation's electronic crimes task forces. And though this expansion has greatly widened the window of opportunity for post-retirement employment for Secret Service agents and for current agents with electronic crimes experience looking to escape the federal government for the more lucrative confines of the technology industry, it has been a disaster for Secret Service morale. This quote from a 2015 Washington Post piece sums up the catastrophic Secret Service morale problem. The Secret Service ranks 319 out of 320 agencies, with a sizable drop in employee satisfaction in all 10 workplace categories. The agency's current index score measuring employee engagement is at a new low, 28% lower than last year, and just half what it was 10 years ago. With the exception of one worse-off agency, number 320 out of 320 on the agency morale scale, it literally couldn't get any worse for the Secret Service. In my experience as a Secret Service agent from 1999 through 2011, mission creep was a significant factor in the destruction of Secret Service special agent morale. But it wasn't the only factor. The Secret Service also had a problem with unresponsive management during this same time period. The management became infamous among the working agents on the protective details and in the field offices for answering nearly every critical question about systemic problems within the Secret Service with, "Because that's the way we've always done it." The 2014 United States Secret Service Protective Mission Panel's report, which analyzed problems within the Secret Service, clearly fingered this problem by stating, "The panel found an organization starved for leadership that rewards innovation and excellence and demands accountability. From agents to officers to supervisors, we heard a common desire. More resources would help, but what we really need is leadership." Secret Service leadership failed the agents on multiple fronts during my tenure with the agency, but one specific management-caused problem was particularly damaging to morale during this period. In the decades before I entered the Secret Service in 1999, it wasn't uncommon for a Secret Service agent to relocate multiple times in his or her career. This need to constantly move agents around the country was due to the agency's protection requirements, which were largely based out of Washington, D.C., where both the Presidential and Vice Presidential Protective Divisions, PPD and VPPD, respectively, were located. If you were an agent hired to work out of an office in Montana, then the standard career path for you would be approximately 5 to 8 years in Montana, a transfer to either the PPD or VPPD in Washington, D.C., a transfer to a second Washington, D.C.-based assignment, and then a transfer back to a field office outside of Washington, D.C. if you were actively seeking a promotion, then you would have to relocate again, most likely back to Washington, D.C., to fill an open supervisory position, either at the Secret